With today's farm news and information, I'm Joanna Guza.
So we're focusing in on some of the health and nutrition within dairy cows. So talking with Dr. Heather White, can you share some of the health and nutrition aspects, research aspects that you've been working on?
Yeah, so a lot of what we work on in the lab focuses around the transition to lactation period, the period where we know she faces the most metabolic and infectious challenges, but those are also the periods where we have the greatest opportunity for impact. So we do a lot of work looking at how to nutritionally support her to make the most milk and most milk energy outcome or output as efficiently as possible while protecting her health. So a lot of our focus is on metabolic challenges like ketosis and fatty liver.
You're probably the first person that I've heard say that there's opportunity after a fresh cow, because I always just hear farmers talk a lot about the challenges. Can you speak a little bit more to what are those opportunity points and how we can change that challenge to opportunity in the farming environment?
Absolutely. I guess I'm an eternal optimist, but if we have challenges and we can have a positive impact on that cow, what we know about the transition period is that if we can help her jumpstart that lactation, not only do we mitigate, hopefully, those health challenges right then in that 3 weeks after calving, but we can also help her reach her genetic potential for milk production, and we can help maintain persistency of the lactation curve. So we can have a long-lasting impact by an intervention that we have only in a very short period of time. Furthermore, what we're learning now is that some of the nutritional interventions we use in the pre-fresh period can also have not only a positive impact on her whole lactation, but on the calf themselves. So now we have even more impact because we've been able to influence the calf's growth and health as well as the cow. So a lot of opportunities there for strategic.
Can you speak to some of those nutritional aspects that you're talking about?
Yeah, one example would be a really long study a really large study we just did with choline. And we fed two different doses of a rumen-protected choline prepartum. So we started at 3 weeks before anticipated calving, and we went to 3 weeks after. We looked at not only the cow, which would be the traditional study that we would do, but we looked at all of the offspring, the Holstein heifer calves and the beef cross calves, because just like many farms around the state and the country, our research farm is breeding the bottom genetic half of our herd to beef semen. What we observed were that cows had improved metabolic profile, tendency for increased energy-corrected milk postpartum that lasted to 100 days. Even though we only supplemented to 21 days after calving. In the calves, we observed better health and improved growth efficiency to weaning and further on in the beef cross calves.
So nutritionally, a lot of focus there. What about their environment? Has there been anything, studies done with the environment postpartum of a dairy cow?
Yeah, there's a lot of people doing interesting work in that. That's not really in my area of research, but there are some researchers that look at the environment and the behavior of the cow, both from a welfare and cow comfort aspect. For example, Kate Kritzinger at UW River Falls is looking at being able to have some privacy when a cow is ready to calve. And other researchers look at things like pen moves or comfort of the bedded pack that they're in and just-in-time calving. So just not a part of my research focus.
Okay. And I know common challenges I can think that a farm might be dealing with cows postpartum is milk fever and not delivering their placenta fully. What advice would you have for someone that's going through some of those struggles?
Yeah, so what we know about those is as soon as the cow has one of those challenges, she's more likely to have another. Most of the time, because once she doesn't feel well, she decreases her feed intake even more. And that's where we can see things like retained placenta or milk fever also become coupled with ketosis because she might enter negative energy balance. So watching that cow pretty closely once she's had the first insult and making sure that we're getting her back on feed, that we're doing a full physical and checking for anything else that might be wrong, just helps us catch everything else that much sooner.
One thing, Heather, that I find interesting is a lot of my audience did not grow up on a farm. Could you kind of speak to some of the similarities between a pregnant woman and a pregnant cow and how they're taken care of both, postpartum wise?
Yeah, this is always a fun topic, especially with our undergraduate students, because a lot of them aren't from a farm either. And so a lot of the things that we can think about for those of us who are women and who have had kids, for those who have watched loved ones or family members go through that, is around the time of calving or parturition with a human baby, you just don't feel like eating. That's a natural part of the adaptation. But our goal is to get that mom, no matter what species, get that mom feeling better and eating and help her make that adjustment. The other thing that we really focus on in my lab is that the body is an amazing thing physiologically. Our body knows that we didn't feel like eating, that we were down on feed intake, and knows that we have all of these changes going on. Metabolically, there's so many biochemical changes that are happening in that time, and those are normal, healthy adaptations. So things like ketosis, if left unchecked, can be really bad, as we all know. But the actual act of ketogenesis is a normal adaptation. So our job as management and nutrition is to help support that. Just the same as with women. Our job is to make sure that they are comfortable, that they eat, that their body can support the lactation and the changes and the recovery that's going on during that period. So a lot of comparisons there, a lot of similarities. In fact, some of the work that we've been doing recently looks at things like fatty liver in cows as a model to understand it better in humans. Because, of course, no pregnant woman is going to volunteer for liver biopsies. And the cows give us a great way to study that. So a lot of similarities.
Right. Now a lot of farms have data monitoring systems. What advice do you have for someone that has a data monitoring system when they're trying to monitor their pregnant and freshening cows?
Yeah, the data monitoring systems are a wealth of data, right? But it can also be overwhelming. One of the challenges with those is that there's no universal threshold across all the many different systems and farms. So it's not like a blood BHB test where we have a threshold above 1.2 millimolar and we need to think about doing something with that cow. These systems, rumination collars, activity monitors, are all each a little different, and your farm system and your management style will influence those numbers, those absolute raw numbers. Mm-hmm. So where I see them the most successful is when you have a person dedicated to looking at the data and digging into it and understanding what the average or normal is on your farm, and then adjusting thresholds so that it's really an alert system, so that you have a threshold that's surpassed or a value that goes below that threshold, and you know, okay, now I need to go look at that cow. You still have to use your cow sense when you get out there and see what's going on with her, but it's more of an alert system or an alarm, and you really get to dig into the data and learn how it's representing your cows.
Temperature's a big thing that you're gauging after a cow freshens. If you could maybe speak to what to notice on those data monitoring systems with the temperature, and if there's any other things that people should not just let go under the radar and just watch temperature, there's other stuff they should be monitoring too.
We do pretty intense temperature monitoring of fresh cows in our protocol, but we're checking every fresh cow every day for 10 days. Remember, that's the research setting, so we need to know anything that goes on, and we're doing rectal temperatures. Haven't done a whole lot with some of the temperature sensors, but again, what we're looking for is deviations. We're looking for one day where all of a sudden she's not as she was the day before. With most of the monitoring systems, that's the biggest thing we're looking for, is a deviation.
And now talking about feed efficiency, what has been some of the research that you've worked on with feed efficiency?
Yeah, the Feed Efficiency Project has been very collaborative. We're actually a part of a multi-institute national collaboration, Michigan State, UW, Iowa State, Florida, University of Florida, and Beltsville USDA Research Station are all involved. And it's a really large collaboration with a nutritionist and a geneticist at each research station, ultimately trying to figure out how to better genetically select for more feed efficient cows. But of course, that means we need to characterize each of those cows along the way. So that's where the nutrition side comes in. We're also a part of a larger international collaboration. So certainly a global effort on feed efficiency. The basic aspect of that effort is that we want to characterize during mid-lactation, when the cow's hopefully not gaining or losing body condition or weight, what the efficiency is on an energy in and an energy out basis. Now, we'd get bored if all we did was measure how much body weight change and how much milk a cow produces based on how much she eats. And so we add a lot of other things. What are nutritional interventions that we can do? What does feed competition or feed bunk management have to do with feed efficiency? And so we're always adding these other aspects to try to get a better grasp on how can we influence it in the meantime. Mm-hmm. So ultimately the goal is to genetically select for more efficient cows. But in the meantime, how do we help the cows we have now be even more efficient today?
Do you have any examples of some of the tests that you've done and some data you could share?
Yeah, so some of the exciting stuff we've been doing is looking at feed bunk competition. We always talk about, should we house primiparous and multiparous animals different, or those first lactation heifers versus the older cows? Mm-hmm. And so some of the projects that we've done look at housing those animals together and grouping them strategically, so they have to either compete with other cows of the same lactation or cows of various lactations. And it turns out it actually negatively impacts feed efficiency for all of the cows when they have to compete with the different age groups. So some really interesting things there. And that's a collaboration with Jennifer Van Oss and Kent Weigel at UW. And we're looking at the behavior aspects that may lead to that. So the feeding rate changes, their feeding preferences and patterns change. So they're going to the bunk at different times. And so we're still teasing out what some of those behaviors are. Now, what does that mean besides telling us about behavior? Well, the really practical nutrition side is that it can help us better manage bunks. It can help us better think about our feeding times and feeding strategies. And then also, if you're on a farm that's large enough to group animals, if we can group them differently to improve feed efficiency, that's certainly a pro in that column.
Mm-hmm. Don't we, and I don't know, this is me maybe being naive, don't farms already do that? Like put them in groups with their age appropriate?
Some farms do. Some farms have enough cows and enough pens that they're able to do that, but a lot of those farms also have a lot of other criteria they may want to group on. So farms have a lot of choices. Do they want to group based on days in milk or based on reproductive status or level of production? Or do they want to group based on parity or how many lactations they are? So all of these are competing for which is the top priority for that grouping strategy. And so part of our job is to figure out how much impact any of these decisions have so that on any one farm they can look at these different criteria and figure out which is going to be the most impactful on their cows.
Right. I feel like it always just comes back to the farming philosophy, how things are set up to make sure that you're being successful. One thing I wanted to talk about, some of your publications on the dry matter intake in mid-lactation Holstein cows, and share some of the research you found with that.
Yeah, so this also was a product of the feed efficiency study. Since we had so many cows, we're doing over 300 cows on this feed efficiency study just at Madison every year. And so one of the things we wanted to do was try to predict feed intake and feed efficiency better. What the limitation on improving feed efficiency is actually measuring the efficiency for each cow. The genomic side isn't the limitation. With the price of SNP chips of cows and genotyping, we could do that on a lot of cows every year if we needed to. But we wanted to dig into, can we predict with lower input the feed intake and ideally the feed efficiency? Two benefits here. One, it would make our life an awful lot easier in research. But the other one is on farm, the biggest unknown is exactly how much every cow is eating. If you think about what you know on your dairy, you know what the pen of cows is eating. And that's just based on what was offered and then what you scraped away the next day, right? But that assumes every cow in the pen is eating the same thing, and we all know that's not the case. We could better manage and feed that pen of cows if we knew exactly how much each cow was eating. So we took a ton of data that was available to us, and we stratified it in different levels. And so we said, okay, here's the lowest barrier. Most of us do DHI milk testing once a month, so maybe we have milk components. And we might have a body weight, probably not from the same day. The next level is maybe we have some sensor data, like you mentioned earlier, or maybe we also have some blood metabolites. So looking at all the data that could be available to us on farm, can we use different combinations of those data in order to predict individual cow feed intake? We actually did that really well using the 6 weeks cows were on study, but that's great in research. It's not great in the real world because it's still a lot of time, right? So the next step in that work was we pared it down and we said, let's take one day. You get one day of milk analysis, assuming DHI came out and tested the milk from all the cows in your herd. Maybe there was a body weight within a week of that day that there was milk sampling. And let's pick some of the other things like genetic PTAs that you would have, the day in milk, the milk production, other variables you would have associated with milk test day. And we used all those to predict feed intake. Now, those models were about 80% correct, which isn't perfect yet, but it's better than some of the models that were available previously. So we're still looking at other factors that could help us predict feed intake better on an individual cow basis. But this is a tool that's now available for nutritionists to work with farms and get a better idea of what the individual cow feed intake is.
And when we look at, I know with different genomic testing and things that have been done, does the size of the cow matter of the feed intake?
So the big cow or smaller cow debate is real. And one of the things that we do within the feed efficiency work is we account for the cow's body size. We can either discount her for that body size because it does increase her maintenance requirement, and we can correct for that. Or we can keep that separate. And so a lot of work has gone into whether or not a big cow is as efficient on a per unit basis as a smaller cow. And there's definitely a threshold at which a big cow doesn't make enough milk to account for that extra maintenance energy. So there is a little bit of a discount there.
Interesting. And I feel like I know at one point we'd always see, and still you can go to dairy farms and see really big cows, but I've actually seen almost more of a transition of people looking towards the smaller type cow because it's using less feed.
Yeah, less feed, the efficiency is better. And then the other thing, and we see this on our research farm just as on privately owned farms, those cows outgrow your facilities, and then you're either left with changing facilities or thinking about how much you're gaining from that large cow size. So there's some really practical concerns that come into play there too.
That was insight from Dr. Heather White. She is a professor in the Department of Animal and Dairy Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the faculty director for the Dairy Innovation Hub, which you can also check out that interview on the Wisco Ag News podcast app. If you enjoyed listening to this topic, please subscribe and rate Wisco Ag News. I'm Joanna Guza with your connection to local agriculture.